Once more into the breach, dear friends. I'll spill the wall up with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff McClure. Jake is out for the week. He's taking a little vacation, which he has distinctly earned. He's one hard-working dude, and we work all during the week, and then we come in on Saturday. Well, we get up early on Saturday mornings and do a lot of research for this radio program, and then we come in here and spend 2 hours talking to foam balls, which if you haven't ever tried talking to a foam ball for 2 hours and sounding interesting, now whether or not we succeed at sounding interesting, that's your judgment, but if you've never tried talking to a foam ball for 2 hours about economics and still sounding interesting and not being forced off the air, you ought to try it sometime. It's an interesting experience. I think it does something to warp our brains. It's probably not a good thing. We're probably legally insane at this point. But we do it, and it is hard work. And we ask ourselves every year when it comes time to figure out whether we're going to do it again about this time of year, whether we want to do it for another year. And so far, for 23 years, we've been saying yes. It's because of the feedback we get from you, the listeners, that we continue to do this. We get some really amazingly good feedback. We get very little, for whatever it's worth, the Personal Wealth Coach gets very little new business out of this radio program. We do get some evidence that our existing clientele listen to it occasionally because we get comments from them. We welcome your comments, by the way. We love to get email or whatever. You can email us at either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com and give us a little kick and tell us that we did a good job or didn't do a good job or what you'd like us to talk about. And we'd love to talk. We'd love to be stimulated by that. Well, there's some good news in the economy. Oh, this is the good news on the radio side right now. We have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Just to make you happy, you do a good job.
Thank you.
Personal finance question. How often should I rebalance my portfolio? How often should I watch CNBC?
I don't watch CNBC.
Okay. I was talking about myself. How often I should rely on Fisher Investment and other things that I get in my mail?
I'm going to tell you, Fisher Investments is a place I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. For several reasons. Let me start with Fisher Investments. Fisher Investments is a private investment firm. They are an accredited registered investment advisor, but they put the money in a privately managed account. And as a result, I think he said he hung up there, so you can take that off. Privately managed accounts are as secure as the manager. In other words, if you suddenly found out that Fisher Investment, like Bernie Madoff or something, had run up a bunch of artificial returns or something, and they went out of business. And I'm not saying that they have any artificial returns. You become an unsecured creditor. I strongly advise people who have significant money that they are either at or are intending to get to financial independence to use a fiduciary unaffiliated with a broker, fiduciary investment advisory firm that's unaffiliated with a broker dealer. Now, a lot of broker dealers who are sales oriented have sister companies that are registered investment advisors, and the same person who is a security salesperson is also an investment advisor representative. I advise people to stay away from that because you don't know which hat the person is wearing at any given moment. And that person is working for a corporation, not for you. They're working with the intent of keeping the corporation happy. If you go over to the RIA side, first I recommend that you use an investment advisor that's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission rather than the state. And the reason is very simple. A state registered RIA is relatively small in the amount of money they have. They don't have the capacity to have backup staff. In almost every case, and I don't know of any exceptions to this, will eventually sell out to a big corporation. That is their primary goal. Now, that's not to say 100% of them are like that, and that's not to say 100% of them are doing it. But in most cases, they're one-man shops or one-woman shops,
And when that person moves on or sells out or gets sick or whatever, you're left stranded and you got to go figure out where to go from there. If a firm has more than $100 million under management, then they register with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And at about $100 million, they can afford to have a staff, a full-time compliance officer. They can afford to have backup, there's a big question there that you need to ask, and that is, what happens when the leader of this firm goes away? Because they will eventually. The second thing you want to ask, and this is crucial when you're dealing with an investment advisory firm like Fisher, is my money protected under the Investment Company Act of 1940? And who is the custodian, and how secure is the custodian? Because what you want to protect yourself against is non-systemic risk. Non-systemic risk is the risk of whatever company you're investing in or through goes under and your money goes with it. If a company uses a secure custodian, one that is very, very stable financially and has adequate backup insurance, including SIPC insurance, and has a very, very firm financial background and firm financial roots, and you do need to investigate this, then you've eliminated most of your non-systemic risk. The Investment Company Act of 1940 is crucial. Mutual funds are registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940. Some ETFs are and some aren't, but if you have a fund where they're picking individual stocks, you're not under the Investment Company Act of 1940. The Investment Company Act of 1940 basically covers pooled accounts like you would have at Fisher. Fisher does not use funds registered under that act. And as a result, the funds that Fisher manages are subject to Fisher's credibility. And if Fisher goes under, your money goes under with him, and you are an unsecured creditor. If you're investing through a company that uses only mutual funds for investment vehicles, then those funds, if that company goes under, your money is still sitting there. It's still in the account. It's still yours, and it's unaffected by the fact that they went under. And it's generally not too hard to find a replacement investment advisor. As a matter of fact, they'll be lining up if you have a significant amount of money and you have it sitting there at some custodian, a secure custodian, you will get to choose among the people who want you to employ them. And that does take a little bit of research on your part or on somebody's part, but it is far better than being in the position where suddenly you can't access your money anymore. Hedge funds are another example of investments not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940, and in most cases not insured. Quite a number of hedge funds have closed this year, and they continue to close, and in many cases they're giving back pennies on the dollar. A couple of major ones recently said you can't take your money out because we're going to liquidate the fund and we don't want to affect the value of the liquidation of the fund. So guess what? When we get around to liquidating the fund, you'll get some of your money back, but until then you can't get any money. So this is one of those things where we see the upside in many cases but don't see the downside. Now, you ask about how often should you listen to CNBC and how often should you listen to other places. I would recommend not. The reality is, and we were just talking about this during the break, that was interesting. I read the Wall Street Journal digitally every day. You know, some of the callers in here read the Wall Street Journal in the print edition every day. That is probably the best source of general economic and investing news that you're going to find, that I know of off the top of my head, is the Wall Street Journal. I also read the Financial Times. I read The Economist. And I keep up with them pretty well. They don't give as accurate a view, I think, as does the Wall Street Journal, because they're both based out of England, and you can tell they're based out of England. They're kind of focused on Brexit right now, which is not a big deal for us, but you have to sort through the news to find the ones that are relevant. Wall Street Journal has done an amazingly good job of keeping their news stories separate from their editorials. Now, the editorials are listed, if you're in the digital version, right there on the face page. I sometimes read the editorials and often don't, because their editorials, frankly, lean to the right somewhat. But that's all right. That's certainly their right to do so. But the key is their news stories and their investing stories don't lean to the right or to the left. They work really, really hard at keeping those independent, even though Murdoch owns the Wall Street Journal, just like he owns Fox News. And he definitely leans to the right, but he recognizes that the value of the Wall Street Journal, in many people's eyes, the people who subscribe to it, has the value is there because they are independent and because they have a very, very carefully balanced viewpoint of the news. Another place I would recommend if you're seriously interested in investing news and opinion is Morningstar. Get a subscription to Morningstar.com and check out all your investments on Morningstar. They, by the way, if you are a person who likes to trade individual stocks and you've got some patience and some wisdom, their recommended stock buys, their five-star stocks, the ones that have wide moats and all of the other varying things that they use to make their recommendations, have done exceptionally well for a long period of time. Although I don't recommend trying to buy individual stocks for a very simple reason. You're competing, when you buy individual stocks, you're competing with organizations that have experienced investment managers and teams of analysts that are literally costing the fund industry millions of dollars a year to maintain, who go out and pick individual securities to buy and sell in circumstances based on what they think the value is. And some of them have done poorly. Some of them have done very well. Generally speaking, when I've measured this in the past and we look at the size of the fund, we factor in the size of the fund, actively managed funds, about 50% of them outperform their index, whatever their index is. Now, what percentage of them outperform the S&P 500? Well, considering that the majority of actively managed mutual funds are not trying to compete with the S&P 500, they're actually trying to compete with a completely different index, that changes the metric quite a lot. If you take the funds that are what Morningstar calls large blend funds, which is the S&P 500 is a large blend index, and you measure those funds according to their size, in other words, the dollars in them, against the S&P 500 consistently over any lengthy period of time, about half of them have outperformed the S&P 500, about half of them haven't. So that kind of the argument that only 15% of funds outperform the S&P 500 or 85% underperform the S&P 500 is a little bit ridiculous because, for instance, a lot of the funds are invested in a part of the market that doesn't mirror the S&P 500. And if you were trying to compete with the S&P 500, you should only use funds that invest in the same part of the market the S&P 500 is in. But Morningstar and the Wall Street Journal are my prime sources of information. And that's not to say that I don't bounce over to CNBC every once in a while or to Fox or to Yahoo or other places and just see what they have to say. But what I have found is their stories are less reliable. They often come out quicker. This is an interesting point. The speed with which we get information on a digital source, such as the digital Wall Street Journal, is very important to some people. If they get that information within a few seconds of it happening, they're very happy. And if it's maybe an hour after the fact before they get the information reported, they get unhappy with it. But the reality is, when you go to the fast reporting sources, they often have errors in their reporting. They'll report it once with some big errors in it, and then they just won't ever address it again. The Wall Street Journal takes some time until they can get the facts before they present the information. I obviously think very highly of the Wall Street Journal, and have found it to be the most reliable source of information that I can get other than directly to the United States government. In many cases, there'll be a link in the Wall Street Journal articles to the government report that they're talking about. Or there'll be a link in there little blue word that you can click on and go back to the original story or the original data that they've got it from if you want to do in-depth research. They're not perfect, but they make fewer errors than anybody else does. So that's sort of the answer to your question. Now, as far as when you should rebalance your portfolio. That's a very, very, very controversial issue. What we have found is presuming that you're following portfolio theory, which is the most successful method of running an investment portfolio. In other words, you're choosing asset classes first. An asset class, for example, mid-cap value stocks would be an asset class. Small-cap value stocks would be an asset class. Large-cap growth stocks are an asset class. So growth or value, large, medium, or small. And then there's others such as real estate stocks, commodities stocks. So there's a whole series of ways to set up a portfolio, but one of them that has proven the most effective over the long term is defined in portfolio theory that was originated by a guy named Harry Markowitz in 1952. And since then, it has been the most effective long-term investment strategy. And if you're not a long-term investor, you're a speculator. If you're a speculator, fine. What I'm saying doesn't apply to you. You're guessing at it anyway, and we're relying on the greater fool theory. But presuming that you have a portfolio that is built according to portfolio theory, or sometimes called modern portfolio theory, then how often should you rebalance it? And we have played around with that quite a lot. And my suggestion is whenever you have an asset class that rises to the point where it's 10% out of balance, and this is, Jake did the research on this extensively over, and he's 40-some years of data. We've discovered that, for instance, if you have an asset class, let's say emerging markets, and you've assigned 15% to it of your portfolio, if that gets to 25, then you should rebalance. Otherwise, you generally are going to miss the boat on that deal. And during major market moves, such as a major correction or a bear market, is when you will see the imbalances occur. And inevitably, in history, now this is not the future, this is what we found from history. For example, if you have a bond element to your portfolio and it's supposed to be 15% and it goes to 25%, why did it do that? Because the equities dropped dramatically and the bond portfolio rose, which happens in bear markets. And inevitably, when it does that, when it gets 10% off, that is in 2020 hindsight, we can look back and say that is the ideal time to take your bond portfolio back to 15% and take that extra 10% of your portfolio and put it over on the equity sides, where you'll find that the asset classes have declined in value. In other words, you're buying at the bottom and selling at the top in the various markets. We have seen recently some parts of equity growth-oriented, I don't mean growth in the sense of asset class, but appreciation-oriented equity portfolio, we have seen some of them that have risen in this bull market to be to the point where they needed to be rebalanced. Of course, there's other times that you should rebalance the portfolio when you have a significant change in your objectives, or when you have a significant amount of money that you add to the portfolio and it throws it out of balance. Those are other times to rebalance the portfolio. As far as a calendar year time to rebalance, there was a time when rebalancing quarterly, if you could do it quickly, gave you an increment, because the big pension funds and the big trust funds and so on rebalance slower than you could do as an individual, and so you could get ahead of them. That time, by the way, is gone with digital management. They rebalance as quickly as you can, so you don't get, there's no more edge there in doing it quarterly. But there is, what we've discovered, at least historically, is whenever your portfolio, any asset class in your portfolio, is 10% out of balance, then you should rebalance the whole portfolio. That was a long answer to a simple question. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jeff McClure. Jake is out taking a short vacation this week. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. You heard this in the news, but it's reality. It appears from MasterCard that U.S. sales, retail sales over the holiday seasons were up about 3 to 4%. And I say that even though they gave a more precise number, the Christmas season was pretty good. 3.4% according to MasterCard. Let's see, it was MasterCard Spending Pulse. Now, what is not been figured in yet is the final data on that. The fact that MasterCard Spending Pulse picked up a 3.4% gain doesn't mean a lot until the final dust settles and the Commerce Department figures out what happens over the period and how December looked in terms of what happened over that spending month. Because, among other things, we don't know what the returns are yet. And by returns, I mean people bought stuff going up to Christmas, but now they're going to send it back, and that takes a gain into a loss. And apparently that has been growing in each succeeding Christmas. And the more online purchases there are, the more it grows. Now, this is another interesting point. In-store sales only rose 1.2%. In other words, bricks and mortar stores where people wouldn't go actually in and buy something were 1.2% better than they were in the previous year. The major retail powerhouses that used to dominate the Christmas sales, Macy's and Nordstrom's, declined by 1.8% this year. Whereas we had about a 19% increase in sales online. We're seeing more and more and more of that. Now, that was an interesting, from if you're an economist, and I am an economist, in our geeky, interesting things, we saw a 1.9% rise in sales in light trucks and automobiles in November. Now, what has that got to do with Christmas shopping season? Well, when you consider that the 1.9% rise in November followed a year of sagging sales in light trucks and automobiles. As a matter of fact, the automobile industry sales declined 0.8% year over year in December. I mean in November, by the end of November. In other words, look at what happened over the trailing 12 months. It actually had fallen 0.8%. But suddenly in November, we saw this surge of sales. And one of the big questions that immediately popped up in my brain is why did that occur? And we didn't get that until very recently. And what we figured out recently in some research, some other people were researching it as well, and it was in the journal, it was light vans, delivery vans, that caused the increase. Light trucks and which include vans, delivery vans, were the, where the big increase in sales were in November. As a matter of fact, the sales of automobiles, cars, decreased in November despite the 1.9% rise in light trucks and automobiles. And I was saying, did people just decide all of a sudden November we're all going to go out and buy pickup trucks? And if you've been anywhere other than Texas in the United States, you realize that pickup trucks are not exactly the predominant vehicle that you see on the streets. But what you do see on the streets a lot, generally blocking one lane as they're unloading and loading stuff, are delivery vans. And FedEx, among others, did a huge surge in delivery van purchases indirectly. I don't know if you've noticed, but when FedEx delivers, generally speaking, now it is not FedEx. Although it says FedEx on the truck, you'll see that is contracted by somebody or another. The contractor actually owns the truck. So FedEx let out a lot of contracts rather than delivering the stuff themselves late this year because they were falling behind UPS in the speed of delivery. And a lot of contractors went out and bought a lot of delivery vans. And a lot, meaning a whole lot. And as a result, they managed to keep up with deliveries over Christmas and surged ahead a little bit. But that's what caused the kick in the rear end for the automobile industry. Which brings me back to the subject we were discussing last hour, why we think at the Personal Wealth Coach we're going to have a recession, a correction, and probably a recession in 2020. Automobile sales are down year over year. Those are a very big predictor of what's going on in the economy. The consumer doesn't stop buying uniformly. When consumers are starting to get tapped out and they're starting to feel like they are coming to the end of what they want to spend, they don't do this uniformly. They start with the big ticket items. They start by putting off buying a car. And they'll continue to buy little things and run up their credit card debt. But they won't go out and buy a new car as often as they would when they feel things are really, really in good shape. We've seen income increases at the low end, which may put some more oomph in the economy, may keep it going a little bit longer. On the other hand, those that 5.4% increase in wages at the low end of the scale easily could kick inflation into some more significant role next year. And if it does, then the Fed will raise interest rates. And if the Fed raises interest rates, then here comes the recession. There's a couple of other cracks in the economy that are showing up that I think are significant. Despite the fact that we in the United States instituted tariffs to support the steel industry, and we saw a surge of old closed plants opening up and new plants opening up, U.S. Steel, United States Steel Corporation, which is still the largest steel producer in the United States, announced it was idling most of a mill near Detroit because the company losses at U.S. Steel are increasing. The issue was right after the tariffs on steel were put in place, the price of steel went up rather dramatically. A lot of steel mills opened up that had previously been closed. New steel mills were opened. It looked like we were going to see the resurgence that the president wanted when he put the tariffs in place. In fact, the high employment facilities like U.S. Steel are starting to shut down now. The reason is the price of steel has now dropped back below where it was before the tariffs. Why did that happen? Because the tariffs caused the price of steel to go up, which meant the people who use steel decided to do less of it. It caused a lot of industries that were planning on building new buildings that had a lot of steel in them to not build the new buildings. And that caused, so the demand fell off for steel. At the same time, of course, these industries in many cases are getting hit by tariffs that are reducing their sales. All of this is occurring at the same time. And then we had this surge of new companies opening, our new companies, new factories opening up to make steel that are highly automated and employ relatively few people. The net result is really ironic. Here we are well over a year after the introduction of the steel tariffs. And what we're doing is, what we're actually seeing is a net layoff of employees in the steel industry from before the tariffs. Why? Because the places like U.S. Steel, which have old plants that are very labor intensive, are no longer competitive, and U.S. Steel is planning to shut down some more plants. And when they open up new plants, and they are planning to open some new plants up, those new plants will employ about 25% of the number of people per ton of steel, or per 100 tons of steel that's produced, because they're fully, because they'd be more automated, so they'd be more competitive. This is one of those ironies that repeats itself through history. Whenever we try, when there's an economic trend going on, there's an economic change going on because of new technology or because of higher competition between regions or parts of the world, countries very commonly, governments very commonly try to act to stall out that change. They try to get involved in what's called industrial policy and put the brakes on the change in technology or the change in the economies that's going on so that they can protect workers. It has never worked in history. It literally does not work, and it isn't working in this case either. It's a valiant attempt by people who haven't studied economics or read much in history. It's far more effective. Every study that I've ever read has said it's far more effective to take the people who are being laid off because their industry is fading or becoming automated, which is what's happening in the steel industry and the aluminum industry. It's becoming far more automated. And retrain them into areas where their job skills are needed. Does that work for everybody? Absolutely not. Because an older person is harder to retrain. In many cases, they have to move to a new location to find the new higher-paying job. One of the things that's been going on in the economy, and we reported on this last week, but it's still a very significant effect. When people lose jobs in the automobile industry, in the and in the steel industry and other heavy manufacturing industries, which they have been doing over the last 5 years, then what we see is when those people are rapidly reemployable. But they're reemployable at typically at least a 30% cut in wages. So there's more jobs available in the United States today than there are people looking for jobs. And that's a plus in many ways. The problem is that many of those jobs that are available don't don't pay a lot of money or they require somebody to move to a new location to take that job, and they have to do a trade-off between the two. And if you've got a mortgage on a house that may be worth more than the mortgage in Detroit, or the house may be worth less than the mortgage, or you get kids in school in Detroit and you don't want to move, in many cases what's happening is people who got laid off in the automobile industry, for example, wind up taking two jobs, both of which pay less money. Together, they pay less money than the guy was getting on the assembly line working at General Motors. And this is not anything unique to this point in history. It's happened over and over again when there's technological innovation and when there's transportation innovation. Transportation is probably the biggest disruptor, and that's what's going on in the economy in many ways. Let's see what else we got here. The bottom line to the economy, wrote this in the newsletter this week, the bottom line remains the same. Retail sales are growing, but the underlying part of our economy that produces things to sell continues to shrink. The stock market's pushing its upper limits as far as price-to-earnings ratios, and I think we're seeing the beginning of market euphoria that ends a bull market. The market is right on the verge of passing through a current year price-to-earnings ratio of 25. And when it does so, inevitably within about, well, so far, historically, within a year of passing through 25, we see some type of significant market correction. So you might want to fasten your seatbelts and get ready. And, of course, the way we say to get ready for a market correction is fairly simple. If you're dependent upon your portfolio for income or may need to take lump sums out of it, for instance, if you lose your job or whatever, you should have enough money in your reserve, and that's cash and short-term bonds, high-quality short-term bonds. You should have enough money in short-term reserve to cover those possible needs and only invest for the long-term, and that's in appreciation-oriented investments. Only invest as much towards the long term as you can afford to leave for the long term with a great deal of certainty. There is no absolute certainty in the world, but and that means 10 years. If you can't afford to leave it there for 10 years, then that is not a good place to have your money, because the last thing you want to do is have an emergency come up or a need come up or a job loss come up. And you need to take money out and the market's down and you have to take it out of the market. You want to avoid that. But just don't ever get greedy. There's an old saying on Wall Street. Bulls make money, bears make money, but pigs get slaughtered. And that is the point. If you're overinvested, if you don't have good cash reserves, if you don't have good, short-term reserves, and you have decided that the stock market is a safe place to be, and you load all your money in there, you can be in a world of hurt when the market turns down and you have a need for that money. So let's see what else is going on in the bid-wide world. It's a good time to do commercials. Yeah, okay. So we're going to take a commercial break. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is out on vacation this week, and the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. We've got several other things we can talk about. Actually, I could talk about the big picture. Do I need to talk about the big picture? The really big picture instead of the little stuff? There's lots of little stuff out there. The fact that auto loans are going delinquent and people are driving fewer cars, and there's a lot of things going on that are significant in the short-term view. But in the long-term view, there's bigger things. We at the Personal Wealth Coach have a hypothesis. You notice they didn't say theory. Theory is something that has not been disproven, even though a great deal of effort has been made to disprove it. We have a very strong hypothesis that history repeats itself, or at least it rhymes. George Santayana, actually his name is Jorge Santayana, was probably the greatest philosopher of the 20th century. And he said, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. He also said a lot of very fascinating things that other than that. But that's the one that's referenced in this case. We're doing a near-perfect 100-year cycle repetition in economics right now. I've mentioned this before, and there's even a good theory behind why that's occurring. The theory is contained in a book called Generations: The History of America's Future, 1584 to 2069, by Strauss and Howe. And again, that book is called Generations: The History of America's Future, 1684 to 2069, by Strauss and Howe. And it predicates that there's about a 23 to 25 year generational cycle. Excuse me. That goes on, and there's only four generations that just repeat themselves. And they make a very, very strong argument that history can be explained through that theory. And they wrote this book in the late 20th century, actually in the 1980s. Published in 1991, I think, if I recall correctly. And it predicts exactly what's going on today. And that also explains why there was a banking or financial panic in 1907. And we had another one in 100 years later. Actually, ours occurred in 2008, 1 year off. It explains why there was a stock market crisis, a panic, and a severe recession in 1873 and in 1973. It explains why in 1898 and 1998 we had 1898 we had almost identical downturns in the market. It explains why in 1900 and 2000 we had almost identical downturns in the market. So if we accept that as a valid theory, we also then note that in years ending in zero, we have major market corrections and usually recessions. We had one in 2000. We had one in 1990. We had one in 1980. You start back through time, and you see them. They're sometimes off 1 year, but they're amazingly consistent. Now, why it's every 10 years, your guess is as good as mine, but it has occurred consistently through history. We obviously had one at the beginning of this century. In 2000 is when the market tipped down. We've forgotten that. We had one definitely going. It started in, it bottomed in 2009, but we had one going on in 2010. So when's the next year ending in zero? It starts in a few days. And that is a strong indicator that we will probably have a market downturn within a year of 2020. Well, since we didn't have one in this year, in 2019, there's a very high probability we'll have one in 2020. Of course, it could be delayed until 2021. That's one of the things we factor into what's going on. And then we start looking to see if there's any other evidence out there to support that. For example, the falling automobile sales. The fact that the Fed is having to, since September, pump billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars per day into the cash economy in the United States because there's a shortage of cash in the country, which means it's increasing its balance sheet. Now, what does that mean? The Fed is stimulating the economy right now. Not intentionally. They just recognize that there's a side of the economy, the short-term money market side of the economy, that isn't functioning on its own. It's not functioning regularly. The banks are not allowing it to function because there's a shortage of cash. So they're actually buying treasuries from the banks, which puts more money into the system, which is what they get paid to do, by the way. That's their job. We had the personal consumer expenditure index was reported out this last week. Inflation is running 1.5 to 1.7% in the personal consumer expenditure index. If you leave out the food and fuel elements, why do you want to leave out food and fuel? Because they're very, very volatile. Which means that inflation is running at an amazingly low level. So it's the job, that means there's a shortage of money someplace. Fed's job is to pump money into the system to keep that from getting severe. And there's definitely a shortage of money in the money center banks where the credit cards are covered and things like that. These are all indicators that there's stresses in the economy, and we'll probably see a recession in 2020. Well, what's the bigger picture? If that hypothesis we have and the theory that backs what's going on from the book that I mentioned just a moment ago, then if that's true, then we should see a boom in the 2020s. Do we have any evidence of a boom in the 2020s? Yes, we do. Next year, there are scheduled to be a major rollout of electric vehicles in every major automobile manufacturer has converted significant factory capacity to the creation of electric vehicles that are semi-automated. And in case you haven't bought a new car recently, new cars are semi-automatic driving cars. You can't take your hands off the wheel and forget about it, but they hold themselves in the lane. And what we're going to see is, instead of the sudden arrival of totally automated cars, we're going to see an incremental arrival of automated cars. And this will cause a surge in that activity going into the 2020s. There are already self-driving trucks. That's not to say they don't have a driver in it, but they're trucks that drive themselves down the highway. And in many cases, those trucks have run in convoys where there's like four trucks. This is an experimental test so far, but it's going on consistently in Australia and is starting to take place in the United States, where on the interstate there will be four trucks traveling in a convoy. One driver in the front truck and that's it, very much like trains. Trains used to have a crew of people in the caboose and at least two people in the engine. Now the whole train has one engineer. So this is a trend that is not something new. And we do have a caller on 773-1400. So you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. That's kind of interesting on what you're talking about there. Would you say the embryo state of this technology came about with a cell phone, you trying to find someplace, turn here, go there, go up here, wherever? Do you think they incorporated this with the non-drivers and vehicles? And by the way, how safe is that really going to be? You have a good day, sir.
Well, I think they're related to each other in that that's one of the reasons that Google is one of the leaders in self-driving automation. But they're discovering they need greater detail, and they're experimenting with it in Phoenix, by the way. They've discovered they need greater detail in the photographic coverage of the roads for these cars to work efficiently, and we're seeing that actually occur. How safe are they? Phenomenally safer than human drivers. I mean, phenomenally safer. There was one person killed a while back in a Tesla almost self-driving car. It made national headlines. One person. If five people are killed between Temple and Belton today in an automobile accident, it may make the local paper, but it certainly won't make national headlines, which should tell you a lot about this. The fact that we are killing 30 or 40,000 people a year on the highways makes multiple death accidents non-news. If somehow everybody was driving a Tesla, we would decrease the fatality rate by a probable about 90%. In other words, we would save, we would see 3,000 to 4,000 people a year being killed. We would literally save the lives of 36 or 37,000 people a year in the United States if we went to semi-automated driving technology today. When we go to fully automated driving technology, and that will occur in the next few years, next decade, we will see traffic fatalities being treated like aircraft fatalities. If you were able to listen to the news last hour, or this last news that came up, there was a national news because there were five people killed in an airplane, in a small airplane accident. Somewhere way away from here. It's national news. It's national news when five people are killed in an airplane accident. It is not national news. It's sometimes not even local news when five people get killed in a local in a car accident. Probably one of the most dangerous things you can do is get in your car and drive someplace on a highway, particularly on a two-lane highway. We did a really good job of reducing the fatality rate up to the point when the cell phone became very popular. Driving while texting, driving while talking on a telephone is about as dangerous as driving drunk. That's why it's illegal in many cases, but still people do it, and it's still legal to talk on your telephone while you're driving in the state of Texas, unless you're in a school zone. It's illegal in California, but tremendous amount of disobedience to that, and it has increased the fatality rate dramatically. The fatality rate for automated vehicles where they've been tested has been astonishingly low. It's like less than one-tenth of the fatality rate per 100,000 miles that we're seeing in regular automobile accidents. There have been thousands of people killed in Arizona this year. But there was one person who was hit by a self-driving car and made national headlines, and it was a big deal. They say maybe we shouldn't do it because one person died. Believe me, the safety of an automated driving system is phenomenal. Just like the safety of airplanes, part of the reasons the safety of airplanes has become so phenomenal, commercial airliners, is because of the tremendous amount of automation that's in there. Let's go back to the big picture again for just a moment. The 1920s were a boom period, just like there was a century before. 1820s going into the beginning of the 1830s was a tremendous boom period. Why? Because tremendous technological innovation followed the recession that occurred before. If we get a recession this year, it will be the kickoff for tremendous technological innovation. It will result in large number of people being unemployed, which will mushroom out, if our hypothesis is correct. Around 2030, we will get a major economic correction, major socioeconomic correction, and it'll be global. It won't be as bad as 1929 into the 1930s because we've learned a few lessons along the way. Each successive downturn in a century gets less severe because we've learned a few things. We've got safety nets that we didn't have before. Not coincidentally, in about 2034 is when Social Security Trust Fund technically runs out of money. Medicare runs out of money. The military retirement system is no longer affordable. We get a whole series of crises that are going to come together sometime around 2030 or shortly thereafter. The 2034 prediction, by the way, is based on the assumption of a steady state economy. If we get a collapse that starts in 2030 or 2029, then it will accelerate that process. So in the early 2030s, we will get if our hypothesis is correct, we're going to get a severe downturn. And it's a good idea to be thinking, studying history and understanding, or having somebody that is strategically oriented managing your money that will look at that and say, yep, that's probably coming. And what worked the last time around and the time before that? Because there's patterns there that can be picked up on. These may not be critically important things for somebody who's 70 years old like I am, although at 80 in 2030, I think I still probably will be kicking around, and it will be pretty important to me. And how to deal with that is something that we should be thinking about 10 years in advance, although people generally don't think 10 years in advance. We do at the Personal Wealth Coach, but that's our job. There was a question we had before the hour, and I'm just now getting to it, about millennials and their investing. Millennial investing processes are far different than the other ones we've seen. ESG is critical to them. In other words, sustainable growth companies that are helping the environment, because millennials, generally speaking, are very, very interested in saving the world. The boomers are not. And there's the main investors today are the boomers. Talk about Bitcoin investing. There's still some people trying to use Bitcoin, although it is probably an extremely dangerous place to invest. That's the understatement of the century. But when you've got a lot of time and you think you're immortal and you think the big riches are likely to be had, then some millennials will jump on it, but they don't have a lot of money to jump on it, so it's not a significant factor. That's just the reality. And you have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jeff McClure. And if you'd like to contact the Personal Wealth Coach off the air, we are an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. And we work generally with people with enough money that they are financially independent and want to retain that money and have it last the rest of their life. Then you're welcome to give us a call at 254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 1-800-914-PLAN. You can reach us by email at either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. And you can email us if you just want us to talk about something on the radio or if you have any kind of simple economic question that you want to answer. Want answered, we'd love to jump on that. We don't require that you have $1 million to ask us a question through email. And in many cases, we see people with less than $1 million. You can also go to our website, which is thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and you can listen to our podcasts, you can read our newsletters, you can see how accurate we've been, and you can research us and see our documentation that we post and we file with the SEC about what we do and don't do. We are a fiduciary, independent investment advisory firm. We work solely for our clients, and that's the way we like it, and we'll continue to do that. So you have a good new year. Be careful out there. And until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.